This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida has a chief science officer, Thomas Fraser, director of the University of Florida School of Natural Resources. In this brand new role, Fraser will oversee the newly established Office of Environmental Accountability and Transparency. Coming up, we'll hear a conversation between 90.7 environmental reporter Amy Green and Fraser about his priorities, among them tackling Florida's troubled waterways. But first, a water issue that affects Melbourne residents. The water is safe. Those were the words of Melbourne Public Works and Utilities Director Ralph Reipelsberger as some 200 residents gathered this week for a town hall meeting on the community's drinking water.
They have a little odor, they have a little high chlorine smell to it, they have a funny, funky little taste to some extent, but the water, through all our testing that's been reported to DEP, the water is safe to drink.
So that's sound from a meeting in Melbourne earlier this week. Well, 90.7's environmental reporter Amy Green covered the meeting. She joins me now. Amy, what is going on with Melbourne's drinking water?
Residents say it looks, smells, and tastes funny. Reipelsberger says the utility has received some 70 complaints since the beginning of July. The complaints coincide with a toxic algae bloom on Lake Washington, and this is a lake in the headwaters of the St. John's River, and it serves as a primary drinking water source for Melbourne and surrounding communities like Melbourne Beach, Melbourne Village, Indian Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Palm Shore, Satellite Beach, and unincorporated Brevard County. The St. John's River Water Management District has detected the neurotoxin saxitoxin in the lake, but officials like Reipelsberger say the utility's water treatment process eliminates the toxin from the drinking water supply and that, as you heard, the water is safe to drink.
Right, but clearly a lot of residents at that meeting and the notion that there may be neurotoxin in there a little bit concerning, I'm guessing. What do those residents say?
Yes, well, this was a packed meeting, and for many, that just wasn't good enough. This town hall meeting basically was a question and answer session for concerned residents with officials like representatives from the Department of Environmental Protection and the Water Management District. And many residents were angry, frustrated, and fearful. Here's Nancy Kirby, who says her water smells like mold and that she and her children all have upper respiratory infections.
I am not crazy. There is nothing worse than telling a mother of four sick children, two of which are long-term NICU babies, that their kids are not sick. It is disgusting. It is appalling as a mother. And it is just a slap in the face to our city.
Right. You get a sense of the anger and frustration there from some of those residents. Amy, what do you know about Lake Washington and why it might be experiencing this toxic algae bloom now?
Right. Well, we've heard a lot about toxic algae blooms in the state of Florida. What kind of sets Lake Washington apart is that it's kind of in this pristine area. It's not in a place where you would expect to see a lot of algae blooms because it's not a place where there's a lot of development around it. Reipelsberger during the meeting said that this year we've had hotter than normal temperatures earlier in the year, and also a recent lack of rain has lowered Lake Washington to a level where it's created a situation of minimal flow through the lake. And stagnant water like that is a place where toxic algae can thrive. He said that we've also experienced a reduction of water demand in the area. And again, that lack of flow in the system, when you don't have flowing, moving water, that can also create conditions where toxic algae can thrive.
Amy, obviously this isn't the first toxic algae bloom we've heard about in Florida. You mentioned at the start of our conversation that it has been in the news a lot. We've heard a lot about Lake Okeechobee and some of the problems that residents out on the coast have faced. How unusual is it, though, for a toxic algae bloom like this one to affect drinking water?
Right. Well, this is a very unusual situation in Florida. We've heard a lot about toxic algae blooms and concerns with health associated with exposure to lakes and rivers where this toxic algae is found and where people like to boat and fish and swim and these kinds of things. But this situation in Brevard County is very unusual because most Floridians get our drinking water from groundwater. Mm-hmm. Melbourne is one of very, very few municipalities in the state, maybe fewer than two dozen, that gets drinking water from surface water. And in Melbourne, 2/3 of the drinking water comes from Lake Washington. And not surprisingly, one resident at Tuesday's town hall meeting wanted to know why Melbourne's primary drinking water source isn't groundwater. Here's what Reibelsberger had to say about that.
We just received a 30-year CUP from St. John's. I think it's one of the first or the only so far in St. John's. And what we're doing is we'll be improving our raw water selection to be coming from groundwater. So instead of being a 1/3, 2/3 lake water, we're going to be closer to a 50% groundwater, 50% surface water capability.
And there he's referring to a consumptive use permit with the St. John's River Water Management District. So in this case, Lake Washington is considered an alternative water source. The St. John's River Water Management District and other water management districts actively are working to identify new alternative water sources as the state's population continues to boom, and that stresses existing drinking water supplies. So, Matt, that means a situation like this that now is very unique in Florida in the future may not be so unique. And you may remember in 2014, a similar toxic algae bloom on Lake Erie in the Great Lakes virtually shut down Toledo, Ohio.
And that's because that area of the country, they rely primarily on that source of water for their drinking water.
On the surface water, exactly, Lake Erie.
This is kind of maybe a little bit worrying for Florida, then. We should perhaps be paying more attention to these toxic algae blooms because more municipalities may be experiencing things like what Melbourne is going through right now.
Exactly. And kind of in contrast to what we mentioned earlier in the interview, Matt, water conservation is another really important thing. We need to take care of our existing drinking water sources, and that includes our aquifers, our underground, our groundwater drinking water supplies.
I wanted to just come back to something that one of the residents mentioned to Nancy Kirby, talking about what the water smelt like and some of what she said were the impacts of it, the upper respiratory problems. How does that kind of tally with your experience of going and sort of seeing and smelling what that algae smelt like on the coast in South Florida a year or two back?
I think what she was experiencing with her tap water was different from what Floridians were experiencing with the blue-green algae blooms in the water bodies. Those toxic algae blooms in freshwater bodies like Lake Okeechobee and the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers, those are very, very terrible experiences. The smell is just overwhelming and can cause you to feel very sick very quickly. But I think what we saw at this town hall meeting this week, the level of frustration and fear kind of points to how fundamental, you know, what a fundamental resource drinking water is. And, you know, if we don't have it, we die. And so that's why these residents are so concerned. It's a resource that we take for granted. When we have it, we don't notice it. But when we don't have it, it's a big problem.
Do you get the sense, Amy Green, that there was some resolution for those residents at the end of that meeting, or are some of their questions still unanswered?
This meeting this week was primarily a question and answer session. Many residents did bring up policy ideas. The meeting was hosted by Representative Randy Fine, who said that these ideas would be considered going forward and as the legislature convenes in the next session.
Amy Green is 90.7's environmental reporter. Amy, thank you so much for your time.
You are welcome.
For more on the big picture approach to Florida's troubled waterways, we'll hear from the state's new chief science officer. Thomas Fraser is director of the University of Florida School of Natural Resources. He spoke to 90.7's Amy Green about his priorities in this newly created role.
Toxic algae thrives in warm waters, which is why we see it during the summer. Where are we seeing toxic algae this summer?
So we're seeing toxic algae blooms in many of the places that we saw them last year. You know, algal blooms were pretty common and prevalent on Lake Okeechobee last year. We're seeing algal blooms there again. We've seen algal blooms in the St. John's River as well. But that's the primary water bodies that have been affected thus far.
And why are we not seeing as much toxic algae this summer as we did last summer?
I think rainfall patterns have a lot to do with that. I think rainfall helps deliver a lot of nutrients to these water bodies. And when you have reduced rainfall, you have reduced nutrient availability and, in general, less algal blooms.
Talk to us about your position as chief science officer. Whenever I cover this stuff, everyone always kind of says the same thing, which is that we have to do what the science says. But no one agrees on what the science says, which kind of puts you right at the center. So how are you balancing agricultural with environmental concerns and also other stakeholder concerns like for growth and development?
A primary focus of mine right now is, as you pointed out before, is to deal with some of the harmful algal blooms. Those algal blooms have pretty significant economic consequences for our state, and we realize that there are a number of contributing factors to the blooms. Chief among those is the introduction of excessive nutrients into our water bodies, and there are a lot of different sources, agricultural sources. There are sources from septic tanks, for example, and just a number, I guess, of inputs that we have to be concerned about. And my goal really is to look at those different sources and identify the magnitude of their contribution to the problem and help identify solutions to reduce their inputs.
Governor Ron DeSantis also has appointed a 5-member blue-green algae task force. What are some of the other options the state and the task force are considering to help make Florida's waters safe for summertime boating, fishing, swimming, and other recreational activities?
First of all, I'd like to say that the task force is comprised of 5 individuals, and all of them are very accomplished academics, right, and scientists, and it's their input is very important as we move forward trying to make the best decisions, how we invest our resources to attack the nutrient problems that we're seeing today.
Ultimately, the task force is charged with recommending policies and regulations aimed at rescuing Florida's waterways from toxic algae. How soon can we expect to actually see a difference in our waterways?
Nutrient pollution, it's a big problem. It's a challenging problem. And the algal blooms that the state experiences aren't going to go away tomorrow. We're hoping to implement policies and projects that will have a long-term lasting effect on our water quality, but it will take some time. Hopefully by prioritizing some projects, we'll be able to demonstrate success in selected watersheds in a very short period of time that will enable us to move forward with similar types of strategies or approaches to tackle the problem in other water bodies around the state.
What kind of projects?
So we have a number of nutrient reduction projects. Some of those projects involve, for example, converting septic to sewers. We have nutrient reduction strategies that are in watersheds, nutrient removal programs. We also recently put out what we call an information for request for innovative technologies to try to bring new approaches and or techniques to combat and clean up algae blooms and also prevent them.
I wonder if you can talk about how the state of Florida is engaging with other states on this issue of nutrient pollution. I know that it's a big issue, not just for Florida.
Yeah, and that's a good point, right? Florida's not the only state in the nation that's dealing with blue-green algae blooms. We see this in the Northeast and the Midwest, and Mississippi actually recently had a very significant problem of their own. So we do talk with individuals in those states about their issues and how they are tackling their particular problems in a way to exchange information to make good decisions on our end as well as on their end.
How unusual is it for a state to have a chief science officer like here in Florida?
I think this is the first one, so to my knowledge. The position was established as part of the governor's executive order, which, as you know, came out pretty early in his tenure in Florida. So he established not only that position, but the position of a chief resilience officer. And as it relates to the chief science officer position, the Office of Environmental Accountability and Transparency. So I think all of those things were intended to bring science to bear on some of the challenges that face the state, be able to communicate those challenges openly and effectively to the public, and let them know what we're doing to solve the problems.
Is that a lot of pressure for you to be kind of not only at the center of all of these very complex issues here in Florida, but also to be the first in the nation?
There's a little bit of stress. but, no, to be honest with you, it's an excellent challenge. It's a great time to be working for the state. I think the headway and the investments that we're making are really positive, and I'm actually really excited to be able to contribute in that regard.
Can you talk about some examples?
Again, I have the opportunity of working with the Blue-Green Algae Task Force to help identify some data gaps or science needs that will allow us to collect the information that we need to make better investments, again, moving forward, to identify the projects that are going to get us the most bang for our buck as we attempt to solve these problems moving forward. So working with our partner agencies, whether it's the FWC, the Department of Health, the Department of Agriculture, to think about how we can come together collaboratively to help deal with these problems, because they're widespread, they're challenging, they're not easy.
So going back to the Blue-Green Algae Task Force, the task force also has called for ideas from the public. Can you talk about some of these ideas that the task force already has received?
Yeah, so again, as I indicated before, we put a request out at, I guess it's called a request for information, and we've had, probably about 100 responses to that request. And so people are able to present or provide their ideas on how they might be able to prevent, combat, or clean up algal blooms. And there's a wide range of approaches and methodologies that we received. Some of them are biological in nature, some of them are chemical in nature, some of them are mechanical in nature. We're evaluating all of those. There are some really good ideas, but we certainly want to be able to vet them and make sure that we understand the potential problems with implementing or deploying any of those technologies moving forward before we actually carry out a kind of a full-scale project in the environment.
Can you talk about what some of the ideas are?
I think with regard to prevention, for example, a lot of those technologies have to do with nutrient removal methods. We know that nutrients are a key source of algal problems, and so that would be one of them. When we see algal blooms, we want to try to remove the algae, particularly toxic algae, from the waterways as soon as possible. So some of those technologies involve kind of innovative, I guess, removal methods. Those would be two of the big ones.
Let's talk about monitoring. Do you think the state is doing enough monitoring on waterways like Lake Okeechobee and the St. Johns River to ensure Florida residents are safe to be on these waterways and to boat and to fish?
Florida's a water state, right? There's tens of thousands of miles of rivers and streams, and, you know, 1,000 miles of coastline, and again, thousands of different lakes throughout the state. So that's a lot of area to cover, and so it's hard to monitor all of those water bodies continuously. So we are strategically thinking about which water bodies that we can monitor with the resources that we have. I think the Blue-Green Algae Task Force in that regard is going to provide some good insights into how we construct and set up our monitoring networks so that we're able to, again, effectively monitor the consequences of our actions, but also monitor the water in a way that we can tell the public what the quality of that water might look like.
We've seen federal and state funding cut in recent years for water monitoring. Under former Governor Rick Scott, water management district budgets were cut, and the Department of Community Affairs that regulated growth was dismantled. How is the DeSantis administration now working to restore some of this monitoring and regulation?
You know, again, I would point to the governor's executive order, and water quality is clearly a priority for him. That's what makes it an interesting time to work in this administration. I think we're doing good things. Part of the dollars that we received, the record funding actually this year, will go to an improved monitoring network to make sure that the water in our states is a sufficient quality.
Can you talk about how this monitoring works or how it's done?
Well, I mean, so there's a lot of different state entities. There are water management districts, you know, and the DEP and the Department of Health and again, the Department of Agriculture. All of these entities play a role in monitoring our water. And so one of the things that we try to do is make sure that we are coordinated in those efforts to collect, again, the information that we need to respond to problems if necessary. There's a lot of monitoring that is carried out across the state with regard to the water quality data that are collected by the Department of Environmental Protection. All of those data are available on departmental websites, and those websites are sponsored and supported by the Department of Environmental Assessment and Restoration.
So where would I, as a citizen of Florida, go for data showing me where it's safe to be out boating and fishing and swimming?
Sure, and that's a great question, and we're working on that right now. As part of our efforts in the Office of Environmental Accountability and Transparency, we're developing a website right now that will, it's a portal essentially that will tell citizens and visitors to the state where water quality samples have been collected that might indicate an algal bloom, for example, where toxic algae might have been identified, and things of that nature. So that's in the process. We expect to roll that out here in the next couple of months.
Okay. And especially for low-income families that rely on fishing to put food on the table, do you think the state is doing a good enough job at communicating this data on where it's safe and not safe to fish?
Again, I think one of the things that everybody's concerned about is making sure that those types of data are available to the public. We work with our partners, the FWC in this particular case, and the Department of Health to identify waters that might pose a significant health risk with regard to fish consumption. So I think that those data are available, and if there's a concern about that, individuals can certainly contact the Department of Health or the FWC. And if necessary, they can also contact this office, right, and we can direct them where they need to be.
Going back to the Blue-Green Algae Task Force, what are the next steps and what are the state's next steps on this issue of toxic algae?
Well, so we'll have a series of meetings. This is an ongoing thing with the task force. I think the next meeting that we have, we're trying to schedule it right now, will likely be sometime in September, and we'll focus more on algae specifically, and particularly the toxic side of algae and how we might deal with that, what we know and what we don't know, and what are the public health concerns surrounding toxins, etc. So
can we expect to see more toxic algae later this summer?
You know, again, it's one of the problems that we have with regard to toxic algal blooms is knowing when they're going to occur. And so that's, with regard to the science, that's something that we're working on, trying to better develop predictive tools so we can address the problems before they become major problems. And because we don't have a good handle on all of the drivers and factors that contribute to algal blooms, it's hard to suggest what's going to happen in the future, though it would not be at all surprising to see more algal blooms across the strait during summer months when the water is warm.
I've been speaking with Florida Chief Science Officer Tom Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Amy. It was a pleasure.
Still to come, the Department of Health and Human Services is investigating potential sites for new permanent shelters for unaccompanied minors. Central Florida is on the list of potential places, But what about minors who aren't housed in shelters? We'll hear from an organisation working to place kids in foster homes short term. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Department of Health and Human Services is looking to build more shelters to house unaccompanied minors. Central Florida is on the list of potential sites for a new shelter, but not all of those unaccompanied minors end up in shelters. Bethany Christian Services works to find short-term foster homes for unaccompanied minors. Laurie Stern is the Executive Director of Bethany Christian Services in Central Florida. She tells 90.7's Danielle Pryor the average stay for unaccompanied minors in foster care is 15 to 30 days.
As I'm sure you've heard, the Department of Health and Human Services says it's, quote, conducting exploratory assessments of vacant properties in Virginia, Central Florida, and L.A. to lease for potential future sites for permanent shelter locations for unaccompanied minors. There's been a lot of controversy about the temporary shelter in Homestead. So what do you think about the potential for another shelter opening in Central Florida?
I can't speak in regards to the shelters. Bethany Christian Services, we provide temporary placement in foster homes. So what I can speak about is just the significance in our local community of the need for these temporary safe foster homes versus these large facilities. We know that children thrive in families. We know that children do best in a safe, loving environment. We know that trauma is decreased. We know that continued risk is decreased. So what I can tell you is that Bethany is in need of additional foster families. And that's really the current need in our current community.
Can you explain a little bit more about what your organization does? Specifically, what has your organization been doing to help these unaccompanied minors?
Sure. So since 1975, Bethany Christian Services has worked with refugee children. And since 2012, we provided that temporary placement in our Michigan and Maryland branches for our foster homes. Since 2018, we provided local in Orlando the temporary foster homes for our youth as well. And we continue to want to increase and provide that capacity because the kids need love, they need care, and they need that family stability.
How does a child get transferred from the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services to Bethany Christian?
Sure. So the Department of Health works with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, who we receive our referrals from. So the Office of Refugee Resettlement has 72 hours when a youth crosses the border to make an assessment of where these kiddos are going to be placed. And that's when we get the calls to say, here's the age, here's where they're from, and here's the sex of the youth. And then we're calling our foster parents to say, here's the three things we know, and will you please open your home? And they always say yes.
What kind of protections, what's the process that you go through in order to make sure you're placing them in really safe homes?
We follow the Department of Children and Family Standards for foster care. So we have child placing agency license. We go through, our foster parents have to go through PRIDE training. So that's that really long training that all of our foster families or adoptive families in the state of Florida go through to be labeled as foster parents. So they go through the training, they have a home assessment, we complete a home study, and we're doing background checks, looking at their license, making sure that everything's safe for our kiddos. We don't want to expose any of our kids to further adverse effects.
Do children get to stay in contact with their parents or guardians, even if they're maybe in another country, obviously?
Absolutely. Visitation and phone contact is super important to our kiddos. A lot of our kids are seeking refuge in the United States, and they have family that's local. So a lot of our kids are able to speak to family members over the phone and have at least weekly contact with their families.
How do you help these children through the legal process of immigration? Because obviously that's the key, right, is to help them find that status or reunite them with their families.
Yeah, so all of our kids go through a legal provider that we work with called Vera. And we have a local legal provider that comes and meets with the youth. And they do a session called Know Your Rights, so that the kids know specifically what their rights are, and it's something that transfers to their sponsor's home. So the home that the youth are being reunified to, they're able to take that information and continue to seek asylum or whatever legal process they're seeking.
What are you looking for in foster parents for these kids?
It's kind of an easy one. We want someone who has a heart to serve, someone who's going to love the kids, someone who's going to not ask a lot of questions and just embrace who they are and where they're coming from, and really just to provide that safe spot for the kids.
How do you attend to other needs of the children, like their medical, educational, social, emotional needs outside of these legal needs?
That's kind of the benefit of Bethany Christian Services having a local program. Even though the kids are staying overnight in foster homes, they come to a program every day and they're receiving education services, recreation, computer skills. We have a nurse on staff that's able to tend to their medical needs. We also have a clinician that's providing individual and group therapy as well. And then we have the case managers that are working on their reunification status.
How do the families of these unaccompanied minors feel about the work that you do, about their kids being fostered?
I think that the families are so thankful. You'll hear from the kiddos when I go and speak to the youth. They tell you specifically about staying at group homes and how they feel so safe at Bethany. They come to Bethany and they feel safe. They feel cared for. And they relay that to their parents in their home countries as well to tell them that. So I think they're very thankful and appreciative that their kids are having their needs cared for.
But are there emotional challenges that the parents face or even the children face about being separated, even if they're in good homes?
I think any time a parent makes a decision because they're fleeing violence, they're fleeing gangs, they're fleeing these horrific things, that I think that I can't imagine as a parent having to make those decisions. But I think that they're just so thankful to have a place like Bethany Christian Services and some of the other local programs that do the same type of work.
So how many children have you placed in foster families so far, and how many parents do you still need?
So we currently have 9 youth in our program as we speak today. We've reunified 12. So we just started accepting kids in April of this year. So that kind of gives you the numbers that to date we've worked with 21 children. We have a capacity of up to 18. We currently, like I said, we have 9 kids in care currently. So the huge pool is to continue to have additional homes. Our goal is 18, but we want even more than that because we understand that, first, we'd love to grow, but secondly, foster parents need that little bit of a break in between as well, and we want to encourage that too.
Absolutely. An Associated Press investigation in 2018 found that there were, quote, holes in the system that allow state court judges to grant custody of some of these migrant children to American families without notifying their parents. What does Bethany do to ensure that this doesn't happen?
I can't speak to that because Bethany, we are reunifying. That is our number one goal, is to get our kids safely with sponsors in the United States, whether it's their biological parents, their relatives, or a family friend that the family is sending them to. We 100% understand that removing children, the kids are already exposed to trauma. Most of them have already had some sense of separation because they're leaving their families. So coming to the United States, it's important for us to seek that reunification.
So adoption isn't an option then necessarily for these kids that are unaccompanied minors?
No, our first goal is always going to be reunification, and that's what we will seek.
What are some of the challenges but also the benefits that parents that have fostered unaccompanied minors have faced?
I think some of it's cultural, learning some of the cultural differences. For example, food. Identifying food that the kids enjoy eating and figuring out what makes them happy with food, just different routines. There's a lot of different routines, and it's just really being open and having that open dialogue with the kids to figure out what makes them comfortable as well.
If someone can't foster, how can they still help these kids?
There's a variety of ways. I always say it takes a village, and that's true in this circumstance as well. It truly takes a village to work with the population. Just because you can't foster doesn't mean that there's nothing that you can do. We have an ongoing wish list that we're seeking different donations for the youth. Perfect items are suitcases. When we're returning the youth to their sponsors, we send them with a lot of items, not just items that are brand new, but also donated items as well. So it's important to have appropriate luggage when they're going on different flights and being returned. We're also always looking for different items that make them comfortable as well. So blankets and book bags and stuffed animals. Those are some of our current needs. Car seats. We love to work with individuals and provide them when they're returned with a car seat or a stroller to make sure that they have their needs met when they're reunified as well.
Why has this been your mission all of these years, but especially here in Central Florida, to offer these homes to these children? Why are you guys doing what you're doing?
Well, Bethany's mission has always been to love children, to love families. And I think that we recognize that family changes everything. And this is the current situation. We recognize that family can make a difference and family can lessen the trauma, family can lessen the burden. And that's what Bethany's always going to stand in the midst of.
That was Laurie Stern, the Executive Director of Bethany Christian Services in Central Florida, talking to 90.7's Danielle Pryor. Up next, music from singer-songwriter Jordan Foley. We're back in a minute.
You do this little thing, we walk on the clouds, oh, hovering.
This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Jordan Foley's been part of the Orlando music scene for a couple years now. The DeLand-based singer-songwriter now has an album under his belt, and he's just put together a band. Foley joins us with a song called I'm Still Going.
I actually wrote it about spoiler alerts in movies. I'm a huge Star Wars nerd, and when The Last Jedi was coming out, I was really excited. And the problem was that I couldn't go see it the day of. I had to go see it the next day. And one of my friends... And I, you know, say that with quotes. One of my friends actually texted me the day that it came out, and said three things that happened in the movie and spoiled the movie for me to that degree. So I went home really upset from work, and I sat down and I wrote the song about how, you know, even though you can have something spoiled for you, you should still go and still give it the credit that it's due. And so I wrote that I'm still going no matter what. So. Don't spoil the movie for me now. I don't want to know how it ends. I waited too damn long just to find out. So don't you tell me anything. Oh, I'd like to erase the mistake I made. Iterating that one line in your message. Gonna take it back a thousand times, but I still know exactly what happens in the show. I can't bring back that feeling anymore, but I'm still going. I'm still going. All the plot twists they got spoiled away. I know you didn't save the day. Might have been harmless, but I'm still the same. As I was in that old picture frame. Oh, I'd like to erase the mistake I made. In reading that one line in your message. Gonna take it back a thousand times, but I still know exactly what happens in the show. I can't bring back that feeling anymore. I'm still going. I'm still going. Thank you.
villain becomes the hero in the end. The underdogs become champions in the end. The couple falls in love in the end. We know there's a sequel, so it's not the end. Would I like to erase the mistake I made? In reading that one line in your message, gonna take it back a thousand times, but I still know exactly what happens in the show. I can't bring back that feeling anymore. I can't bring back that feeling anymore. I can't bring back that feeling anymore. So I'm still going. I'm still going, yeah. I'm still going, yeah. Oh. I'm still going.
Well, Jordan Foley, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's good to be here.
How do you classify your sound? You're kind of in the folk, the Americana, a little bit sort of the country mold.
Yeah. I think folk Americana kind of hits the nail on the head. I do have some country, some alt country, old country vibes, sounds to it. There are some undertones. But, you know, I'd like to classify it as folk Americana. I mean, I've been very influenced by the folk bands of this era, Mumford & Sons, City & Color. Mm-hmm. Shaky Graves. And then you get into like the outlaw country, Sturgill Simpson, you know, Jason Isbell. So I'm very much influenced by them, and I've tried to, you know, kind of mold my own sound, not to emulate theirs, but to, you know, have some sort of relation. Yeah.
I don't think, though, I've ever heard a song that kind of evokes country. It may not necessarily be country, but. Yeah. The key ingredient is Star Wars,
yeah.
And there's definitely a country flavor there. I mean, there's a kind of a sense of loss,
yeah.
And you're talking about Star Wars,
absolutely. There is, and you know, Star Wars is very dear to my heart, and it's actually pretty funny. I play with a violinist in town, Tanner Johnson.
He was on our show,
yeah. Was it with
Luke Wagner?
Yeah, he's a really good friend of mine. Luke and I are very close, and I, you know, Tanner and I play as well, and sometimes, you know, Tanner's on the album, and when we go and play that. The way that it works, the chord progression, the key or whatever it is in, he can throw in Star Wars theme songs into the song.
Mm-hmm.
Bah, 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 and I'm like, that's hilarious. Everybody loves it.
Is there a bit of a folk Americana revival going on in Central Florida right now? There seems like there's a lot of talent out there.
I really do think that there is a bit of a new guard coming up. And we're all influenced by the old guard. And I hate to call them old guard because they're not even old, like Thomas Wynn and the Believers and Mike Dunn and Kaylee Baker and, you know, Beth McKee, Swamp Sisters, you know, like they're in the now, but we're trying to, like, you know, come up with them. I met Mike Dunn a few years ago and I asked him, you know, what do I have to do to just get involved and get into the community so people start to know me and want to hear my music just along with yours? And he said, just be there. He said, just show up. He said, go to Will's Pub, go to Little Indies, go to all these venues that, you know, the Imperial, go to these places and just listen and introduce yourself. And before you know it, people will start to welcome you. So this song is called Clouds. I wrote it at a time when I was in love. So it's very much about feeling that kind of like nothing beats it kind of feeling, that you're up in the clouds and, you know, reflecting on yourself and being surprised at having that type of emotion after going through everything that we go through, and just really, really investing in that feeling and how you never want to let it go. And even like the littlest things could really go a long way. So
– You do this little thing where you walk on the clouds, oh, hovering over me, keeping me so sound. Don't want you to fall, cracks lying beneath you. And I won't ever really know how it might fail to try and make you see the feelings that I feel. So won't you squeeze my hand and don't ever let go. Just so you know that every time I see you, your love drowns my thoughts. Yeah, puddles on the ground. I smile when I see the reflection. Give me, won't you take me there every time? And I do this little thing where I leave your notes all around the room, just to let you know that you want me up every cold winter night. And you let me swoon you, let me be your light. And when I pay the price, you start the fight. So please don't you ever, ever gonna break my walls down. Just so you know that every time I see you, your love drowns my thoughts. Yeah, puddles on the ground. I smile when I see the reflection you give me. Won't you take me there every time? Ooh, just so you know that every time I see you, love drowns my thoughts. Oh, yeah, puddles on the ground. I smile when I see the reflection you give me. Yeah, won't you take me there every time?
Jordan Foley, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
And that interview first aired in September 2018. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Production assistance for today's show from Amy Green and Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.